It's the end of July. Training camps finally come around. The New York Giants and the New York Jets, well, they're about to be back in town. So we brought in the pregame host of all the New York Giants shows, ladies and gentlemen, Lance Meadows here. But for now, we got to start off downtown sports. I am the mouth of the South, John Ciboni, along with my co-host, the Beast of the East, Jonathan Pariente. This is downtown sports. This is where sports come home. Beast, we got to start off this show correctly.
Yes, we
with
do.
With the pregame and postgame hosts for the New York Giants. He hosts Big Blue Podcast, just about everything New York Giants related. He is also a host on Sirius XM, Mad Dog Radio. In fact, he just got off the radio with David Deal. Ladies and gentlemen, I almost want to call him Mr. New York Giants. I'm not sure about that. A lot of people would say Eli Manning is Mr. New York Giants, but I think it's this guy right here. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Lance Meadow, welcome back to Downtown Sports. How you been, my friend? It's been a while.
It has been. Well, I am doing very well. Always good to be on the program with you guys. Thanks so much for having me back on. That was some introduction. I guess I can only respond by saying the check is in the mail, John, and it will be arriving shortly, hopefully.
Yes, definitely, for sure. Let's get into the Giants drafts, just straight up. What'd you think of it? They went wide receiver first round, and then they went linebacker, linebacker, linebacker. They really shored up the interior second level of the defense. How do you think the Giants did in this draft?
I think they addressed the variety of positions in the draft, and I think that was the big positive. First of all, if you look at the two issues for the Giants, number one was their inability to score points last season. 17.5 points per game. I understand they lost Saquon Barkley, and that obviously played a big role. But Daniel Jones in the passing offense didn't light up a storm. So they needed to add more playmakers. And they did that, I think, with Kadarius Toney. There's a versatile player who I think is also going to be a solid return man on special teams. Then Azeez Ojulari, you wind up getting in the second round. This is somebody that also was a solid player in college. You could argue he is one of the most prolific pass rushers in this year's draft. And when you take all of that into consideration, you know, it's something to be excited about. And the fact that you could bring him into the mix and you can have him get after the quarterback on passing downs, I think that was a slam dunk pick. The value for where they got him, I don't think he can complain about that. Aaron Robinson, the cornerback who they brought in, somebody that can play on the outside and the inside, helps their depth at a position in the secondary where you know you're going to need a lot of guys based on who you're going to go up against in the division. So when you take all that into consideration, I think they did a nice job adding to the depth chart. They brought in some versatility. And I think a lot of these guys are going to have opportunities in year one to get on the field and play. And I think that's the goal, especially with your relatively high picks.
In addition, Lance, to the draft picks the Giants got, they also made some very solid free agency signings as well, further shoring up the defensive side of the ball, bringing back Devontae Downs, adding Zach Fulton to the offensive line, getting Mike Glennon as a backup quarterback, Ryan Anderson to add to the linebacking core, Adoree Jackson, another cornerback they added to the secondary from the Titans. And, of course, the big move was Kenny Golladay, the former wide receiver for the Detroit Lions, giving Daniel Jones another deep threat wide receiver. Let's talk about particularly the Golladay signing and how that's going to complement having Toney on the other end of the ball.
Well, the big theme is, as I just talked about with respect to the draft class, is to bring in as many playmakers as possible for Daniel Jones. And I think they did that twofold. I think they addressed it in free agency with the addition of Kenny Golladay. And then, of course, they added Toney later on in the draft. You can never have enough weapons. I think we've seen that across the NFL landscape. You just don't know whether or not everybody's going to stay healthy. So, you know, that's why you can't bank on saying, oh, well, our starters look great. All 22 guys look fantastic. Well, that's great. 3 weeks into the season, you can lose half of those players on both sides of the ball. And then what are you going to do? So, you know, this is why you can always feel as if bringing in more guys adds competition, number one, which is a good thing, but also gives you options that you're confident in, so that the level of production is not going to drop off. When you look at the fact that Saquon Barkley and Sterling Shepard got hurt in week two, I think most people say to themselves, well, you don't have another Barkley and Shepard on the bench. You hope that in piecemeal. And they did, in fairness, run the ball effectively last season. But Wayne Goldman's not Saquon Barkley. Nobody on that roster was Saquon Barkley, because He's just cut from a different cloth. So I think by adding Kenny Golladay, you bring in a huge target. This is a guy that wins the 50-50 balls. He can make explosive plays. He can capitalize in the red zone. And you have a team last year that struggled to punch the ball in. So he, to me, checks off all those boxes for Daniel Jones. And Tony, as I was hitting on a little bit earlier, here's a guy that you could play out of the backfield. He can throw the ball, so he could take on that Golden Tate type of role, which Golden Tate had last season. I wouldn't be surprised if Jason Garrett has a few passes, not an overwhelming amount, but Tony's capable of doing that as a former quarterback. And he's somebody that's going to turn field position in special teams in the return game. So, you know, that's a weapon. Listen, if you return the ball to midfield, that's a great gift for your offense. So he can impact the offense without technically playing on the offensive side of the ball. So that, I think, was big for the Giants to add that type of versatility. But Golladay is something they have not had within the offensive scheme, and that is that tall, big target. You could argue the last time they had that tall, big, reliable target was probably Plexico Burress. I'll give you Hakeem Nicks a little bit. You know, Nicks was a presence, but I think Burress was more of the tower that Golladay could present for the Giants.
Talking with Lance Meadow, he is the pre- and post-game host for everything New York Giants at WFAN Radio, also on Mad Dog Radio. Daniel Jones, it's year three. A lot of people gave him a pass last year because of the no preseason and the new offensive coordinator. I'm not one of those people that did. I'll be honest with you. I'm not one of those people that did. I'm one of those people that when the Giants were up and Justin Fields was still on the board, I was hoping and praying. But I knew Gettleman was going to make a deal with somebody to move out of that pick. But this is Daniel Jones's third year. I think a lot of Giant fans are going to be giving him about 5 or 6 weeks before they start calling for Mike Glennon if Jones comes off to a bad start. Where do you think Daniel Jones is in his development? And do you think he finally takes that step forward this year?
Well, I would agree with you. I think this is an absolutely critical year. It's year three, and normally that's the year for most players that you figure, hey, they're going to take the next step forward. The other reason why I think it's critical is because anybody pointing to the fact that he doesn't have enough weapons or there's not enough around him, I don't think has a lot of substance behind that argument anymore, because I think the Giants aggressively pursued talent, as we just talked about, in free agency and the draft. So last year you could argue, okay, you lost Saquon Barkley. Shepard went down early. Guys were a little bit in and out of the lineup. The offensive line was young. You could point to all those factors as to, okay, it's understandable. And Daniel Jones was learning a new offense once again with Jason Garrett. Well, Jason Garrett is back as the offensive coordinator. You have stability. Daniel Jones hasn't had this luxury since he joined the Giants. So that's not an excuse. We just went over the talent. The only X factor wild card is still the offensive line. And if the offensive line doesn't pass protect and these young guys have their ups and downs, I thought they run blocked very effectively last season. I don't think the team gets enough credit because everybody focuses on Barkley going down. But as I mentioned, guys, look at the numbers. The Giants ran the ball at a respectable rate. It didn't translate to points. That was the problem, meaning they would get down within the 20 and then they didn't have anything to show for it. But getting back to the point at hand, if the offensive line has troubles in pass protection, then to me, it really doesn't matter how attractive all these weapons are if Daniel Jones is going to be pressured. So I bring that up as that's the caveat that you could still throw out as sort of an X factor wild card. But putting that aside, yes, I think the Giants are saying to themselves, Daniel, we've given you the weapons. We've given you the pieces. What can you now do with it? It's show me time for Daniel Jones. There's no doubt about it. It is show me time. But I think what we tend to sometimes get away from or forget is, like anything in football, it's the ultimate team sport with every facet. You take one piece out of the equation, one guy misses an assignment, it's like the domino effect. It could throw everything off. So that's why I keep going back to the offensive line. If that unit doesn't give Daniel Jones the time to truly take advantage of all the weapons, then don't be surprised if he has some of those ups and downs where you see some games where he's capable of throwing for 3 touchdowns, but then you see some of those ugly games where it's like pulling teeth, trying to put points on the board. Because look at what we saw in the Super Bowl, guys. There's a reason why the Bucs made the Chiefs look like a mediocre offense. Why? Because they absolutely dominated in the trenches. And oh, by the way, Patrick Mahomes was the quarterback, not Daniel Jones. So if Patrick Mahomes could be neutralized, then I can tell you damn right, Daniel Jones could easily be neutralized as well.
Let's look at the Giants and the schedule they're going to have coming up this year. Going to be a little different from a normal NFL schedule. 17 games this year. The Giants are going to take on the AFC West and the NFC South. So we're talking Kansas City. They're going to take on Tom Brady. They're going to take on Sam Darnold. How can the Giants attack this schedule? And is it a favorable schedule if you're a Giants fan? Or is this maybe a few red flags you have to kind of look at throughout this whole season?
Well, number one is you have to take care of business in the division, guys, because that's the easiest path to win the division. Now, the Giants went 4-2 in the division last year, which was, I think, a pleasant surprise and a turning of the corner, because if you look based on recent history, the Giants have hovered around 500 or less within the division. But I will say this, the division record, while still very important, don't get me wrong, as you referenced, Jonathan, there's 17 games in the regular season. So with an additional game, you could argue the influence of your division record doesn't hold as much substance as previous years, because guys, do the math. There's now 11 games outside of the division. So if I go 6-0 in the division, let's say hypothetically, but what happens if I only win 3 games outside of that? Okay. 9-8 may not cut it this year. It may not even get you a wild card, depending on how things play out. So you got to be a little bit careful when you talk about, well, you got to win the division. You got to handle your business within the division. Okay. But what do you do also outside of the division? Now, to get back to the schedule overall, I'm not one that likes to overanalyze schedules, guys, because you could tell me about, oh, you love the stretch from week 13 through week 17. Well, what are those teams going to look like? What are the Giants going to look like? How are injuries going to impact those units? A lot of things change on a weekly basis in the NFL. I will say this. I think based on the two divisions that you outlined, the AFC West, I think, has a lot of depth. Justin Herbert had a sensational rookie year. I loved what the Chargers did in the offseason. They bolstered the offensive line. I think Brandon Staley is a very savvy defensive mind, and he's got a lot of talent. Those guys just got to stay healthy. Derwin James, Joey Bosa, those two guys in particular. That Chargers team, I think, is going to be an extremely balanced unit. Denver is returning a lot of firepower on defense, who the Giants are going to see in the first game. I think we're going to learn a lot about that Giants offensive line in week one. I think the million-dollar question is the quarterback. Drew Lock, Teddy Bridgewater, there's some questions there. So probably the defense is going to do a lot of the heavy lifting for Denver. We know Kansas City. We don't need to go over them. And the Raiders have a good offense. The defense struggled immensely last season. Can they meet their offense halfway? Can that be more of a balanced attack? So Denver and Las Vegas, you like one facet. You have some questions on the other facet, but I still wouldn't overlook those teams. And the NFC South, well, Tampa Bay's the defending Super Bowl champs. Carolina is extremely intriguing. I think Matt Rhule has done a nice job building the youth movement there. Atlanta's got a new coach, and they're adding Kyle Pitts around Matt Ryan and Calvin Ridley. Their defense remains a big question, though I do like Dean Pease as their defensive coordinator. And the New Orleans Saints, listen, everybody will talk about there's no Drew Brees, and they're going to have some injuries and guys suspended when they go up against the Giants early in the season. But the last time I checked, Teddy Bridgewater filled in for Drew Brees 2 years ago, did not lose a game, and they did pretty good with Taysom Hill. Sean Payton's got a good track record. I would not sleep on the Saints. The bottom line is what I just outlined. Those are two divisions with some depth. I don't think that's a picnic. I do think the Giants are going to be challenged outside of the division. And I do think, as I just mentioned, how they fare outside of the division is probably going to tell a lot more about their chances of being competitive and making the playoffs, more so than maybe how they fare within the division because of the volume of games.
You also sprinkle in a couple of extra games in there. The Bears, I believe, are going to be someone the Giants will see again. You also sprinkle in Tua they're going to face. Yep. Not very easy. Those are going to be interesting matchups for the Giants, and I'm curious to see how they'll stand up to that.
Well, that's why I think in the early stages of the season, guys, what you're going to learn a lot about is I think you're going to learn a lot about the offense for the Giants, which to me is the million-dollar question entering this season. We could talk about all the talent, and we've outlined that a lot over the course of this conversation, but talent doesn't mean anything if they don't execute and the offensive line doesn't hold up. So think about what you're going to see in the early stages of the season. You're going to see a very good Denver defense that gets Von Miller back. The Broncos, you can make a case, have maybe one of the best secondaries in the NFL. And they added Patrick Surtain to the mix. You're going to see Washington in the division. Washington has one of the best fronts. Look at all those first round picks that they invested in it. Chase Young had a very good rookie year. So that's another very strong challenge. You're going to see New Orleans, which I mentioned. Now, they won't have David Onyemata, who's suspended for the first six games because of PEDs, but Cam Jordan, and I really like who they drafted in Peyton Turner in the first round, kid out of Houston, who's extremely versatile. So my point is, you're going to learn a lot about that group. Now, Chicago, you referenced, Jonathan, they're not going to see the Bears until the very end of the season. Mm-hmm. And you know that game is going to be important because Giants fans are hoping the Bears stink this year. So they get an extra high pick in the first round. Maybe Fields plays by then. Who knows? Maybe Andy Dalton and the Bears defense does a lot of the heavy lifting. So, you know, the Bears are a bit of a wild card. So the reason why I'm not emphasizing that game so much is we got a long way to go. I'm more interested to see how the Giants fare against those opponents I just outlined, because I think that's going to say a lot about, okay, hey, you know, maybe this Giants offense can contend with just about anybody, or, hey, you know, this group still has some issues in the trenches and they're going to have to work their way through that.
Talking with Lance Mehta, the pre- and post-game host for the New York Giants on WFAN Radio. One of the other things I wanted to get to was the big shiny Lamborghini in the room, and that was the Giants defense. A lot of people last year did not have this group being that effective, but lo and behold, they were a top five defense in the NFL. And through the draft, it only seems that they have improved. So what do you think had the Giants playing so well last year, and can it translate to this year?
I think a lot of it leans on the secondary. To answer your question, John, you look at the addition of Logan Ryan. I have said this time and time again. Here's what's so interesting about last season, not to get off topic, but I think this is somewhat relatable. Xavier McKinney goes down right before the start of the season, if you guys recall. He suffered the broken foot. If he doesn't get hurt, I still believe that Logan Ryan may not be on this team right now. So the McKinney injury, and you never want to see anybody get hurt, it may have actually turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because I think it opened the door for the Giants to now say, hey, we need somebody, and we also need somebody with experience who also has some familiarity with Patrick Graham and Joe Judge from their Patriots days. And Ryan's leadership, communication was invaluable if you go back to last season. So that was turning point number one, what Logan Ryan did for the rest of the unit. Because if you remember, this defense struggled early on, okay? The defense, the numbers ended respectable, but it really was a tale of two halves within one season for the Giants defense. First half, very shaky. Second half, they started to work out their issues and they became a consistent group. So Logan Ryan, the addition of him, James Bradbury and Blake Martinez, adding those two guys in free agency, that was huge. What Dave Gettleman was able to do to bring in a shutdown corner on one side, and Martinez is your cleanup guy. He once again was up there in terms of tackles. I will say this. I get asked a lot about most valuable component of the defense. I think it's Blake Martinez. If you were to ask me if there's one guy that they cannot afford to lose this season, I don't think they can afford to lose Blake Martinez. And they lost Dalvin Tomlinson in free agency, who wasn't a big sack guy. And I understand he wasn't a flashy guy, but Dalvin Tomlinson was very good in stopping the run, guys. And they were very effective as a result. If Dalvin Tomlinson is no longer there, well, you're going to need your linebackers to help fill those gaps. That's where a guy like Blake Martinez comes into play. So those three additions, to answer your question, John, that's why the defense played the way it did. Now the million-dollar question, which is I think what you were alluding to, is do we just assume this group picks up where it left off? Or do they have some ups and downs? Because once again, Dalvin is a significant loss, even though the statistics may have not shown that. And then you also want to see what happens with respect to a secondary that I think is going to rely on Aaron Robinson, is going to rely on Holmes, who was a rookie last year, you know, to see if those guys can man the slot. If you have young guys who don't have an overwhelming amount of snaps, sometimes there's growing pains that go along with that. McKinney only played six games last year. He showed some flashes, but his sample size was very small. And then here's the other thing. What happens with respect to the pass rush? Leonard Williams had a great season, right? Guys, that was the only season in his career where he's had double-digit sacks. Mm-hmm. Now, I like Leonard Williams a lot. I think he's comfortable in this scheme, but I'm always saying, you got to show me that you can do it again before we all of a sudden just pencil you in. So it's still show me time for Leonard Williams. Now he's got the contract. Can he have another double-digit sack season? If he can't, what does Azeez Ojulari do as a rookie? What does Lorenzo Carter and Oshane Zimenez do as they return from injury? So my point is there's a lot of movable pieces. I think the Giants are an extremely intriguing team for all of the reasons I laid out, because if everything clicks, whoa, watch out. You know, this group could do a lot of damage. But the million-dollar question hovering over this team is ifs, buts, okay? There's a lot of things that we preface our statements with, and that's why I think they fall into the category of intriguing, because they have the talent, but everything needs to fall into place.
So what are your expectations for people like Joe Judge and for Jason Garrett? Last first year, not many people really knew who Joe Judge was. Maybe, oh, you know, he came from New England. Was he going to cut as a coach? People weren't sure. The Giants defense bought into how Joe Judge wanted them to play. Eventually, it kind of made its way over with Jason Garrett as well. That took a little bit of time. Now that they're both in their second year and you got a good sample size of what Joe Judge and Garrett can bring to the table, what are your expectations for them now in their second year?
Well, Jonathan, the other training camp.
Full training camp as well, yeah.
The other thing that I would add is I think Patrick Graham deserves a lot of credit too as the defensive coordinator, because I think guys bought into what he was selling. And don't overlook the influence he had, because a lot of players on the record said Graham, well-prepared, always had a great scheme in play, was not shying away from switching things up. He developed some of the young guys, the Cam Browns, the Carter Coughlins. So, you know, when you look at Tate Crowder and some of the game-changing plays he made, you know, that was important last season to get those guys some snaps and see what they could do, because this is still a relatively young team. So I don't want to dismiss him from the conversation, but I think Joe Judge handled himself very well in year number one. I think the players bought into what he was selling, and what he was selling is we're going to focus on the fundamentals. I'm going to ask you to do certain things, which may be strenuous, which may not be comfortable, but there's a reason behind it. And you even see it at the start of camp this year. He's a very much heavy guy on conditioning because he treats that as a fundamental, which is important. He wants to know that his guys understand, hey, I'm going to run you in camp. And the reason I'm doing this is because when we get to the fourth quarter of a regular season game, I don't want you to be huffing and puffing. And I don't think many coaches sometimes emphasize that. They're so caught up in the scheme. So it's the little things that Joe Judge pays attention to. And I think players respect him for that. As far as Garrett is concerned, it's always interesting to me. You know, a lot of people love to put Garrett under the microscope and they look back at last season, the offense struggled. Well, I actually think Garrett deserves credit. He lost Daniel Jones for two games, one of which, remember, they beat the Seahawks. They went to Seattle with Colt McCoy, guys, if you remember, and they ran the ball down Seattle's throats. And they really didn't have much offensive firepower to work with. He utilized three tight ends. They blocked effectively. I thought that was an excellent game plan. I also think Garrett had some great plays and great game planning. And I think, as opposed to blaming it on Garrett, the lack of execution for some of the players. Case in point, okay? Let's go to that first Philadelphia game. And they wound up losing. Remember, the Eagles rallied late, and people point to Evan Engram and the fact that he had the ball and unfortunately couldn't come through with it on the left sideline. What was wrong with the play call, guys? I didn't think there was anything wrong with the play call. I think it came down to the lack of execution by a player. Why are we talking about that? Why are we always focusing on the offensive coordinator doesn't know what he's doing? Then you go to the Bucs game. Daniel Jones made a lot of throws down the field. Unfortunately, he didn't connect with his receivers. Sometimes they were overthrown. There were miscues. I like the aggressiveness. I don't think that had anything to do with Jason Garrett.
I saw at least what in that Tampa Bay game, three times wideouts had their men burnt and they were going right down the field. Daniel Jones literally missed three touchdowns. Two of those misses turned into picks.
Yeah. Well, and that's why context is important, guys. That's why I'm bringing this stuff up. It's easy, whether you're a diehard Giants fan or an NFL fan, it's easy to look at numbers or a box score and criticize. Context, though, elements that we're talking about, which don't show up in the box score. Is there a column in the box score for how many touchdown close plays a quarterback misses, or whether or not a tight end or a wide receiver had an opportunity to convert a third down and move the chains and run out the clock? That doesn't show up in the box score. So my point is, nobody's saying that Jason Garrett is the greatest offensive coordinator known to man. Okay, that's not my point. My point is, when we point the fingers and we criticize, it's important to look at all elements as opposed to, oh, it's just on the play caller. And I think a lot of it was the lack of execution last season, more so than Garrett didn't have a good read on his personnel. I thought he made some really nice adjustments. Unfortunately, the level of execution didn't necessarily meet that, and that's why you had very much up and down results. But I think he feels a lot more comfortable this year, Jonathan, getting back to your question, because he's saying to himself, I got a better read of my personnel. I saw what we did well. I saw where we need improvement. And the players are inheriting the same scheme, which is not something they've had the luxury to do over the last few years. Because remember, Pat Shurmur was here for 2 years. Then you bring in a new coaching staff and Joe Judge. So there were a lot of movable pieces. And the fact that they don't have to start fresh this year, hopefully that's something the offense can benefit from overall.
Talking with Lance Meadow, want to get you out of here on this last question. Joe Judge came over and was a special teams coach, but one of the biggest weaknesses last year of the Giants was special teams. And we haven't heard too much about anything that they could have done to fix that. So what moves have they made to shore up those special teams? What are they going to be doing to shore that part of the game up? Because special teams did cost them a couple of games last year.
Yeah, they did have their ups and downs, and Joe Judge was on the record showing his frustration. I can only imagine what went on in those special teams meetings because, guys, this is his MO. He was a special teams coordinator, so if there's anything that you know makes him irate, it's special teams mishaps. You go back to the Bengals game where, if you remember, Cincinnati had a kickoff return, and also they had a great return right before Jabal Sheard forced the late fumble, which to me sealed the game. The Bengals may have gotten into field goal range and won that game. So there's another game that came close down to the wire. You had Deion Lewis fumbled on a return. I forget which game that was, but that was another one where field position came into play. Their coverage units also, I think, struggled throughout the season. So, you know, that's an area that they want to shore up. And then the return game, Jabril Peppers, when he started to be involved in that, that helped. And then Tony is going to help too. So, to answer your question, okay, what did they do on special teams? Number one, drafting Tony, you get an electric playmaker. So that, I think, gives you another option. You don't have to have him return everything, but at least you feel good that you get him out in open space with blocking. He could take some pressure off of your offense because you should have good starting field position. As far as the coverage is concerned, remember, they revolved and relied on a lot of young guys last year. That's not an excuse. That's the reality. When you draft guys who make up the bulk of the back end of your roster. And I was talking about the Carter Coughlins, the Cam Browns, the Tate Crowders. Well, if they're not every down defensive players, guys, they're going to have to play a lot of special team snaps. And when you have young guys that you're throwing into situations where maybe they're not necessarily extremely comfortable with, you're going to have good and bad results. So I think what helps them by default, there's a lot more experience coming back on special teams. That's number one. I also think they brought in through the draft some players on the back end of the draft who had some special teams experience, which I think is very good. So, you know, the running back that they brought in out of Arizona State, you know, he's somebody that was a four-team special teams player. So that, to me, is something that is going to bode very well. And he jumped out to them on film because he knew that when I get out on the field, I got to make some noise on special teams. And you like having guys on the team who want to play special teams. I remember, if you recall, Dwayne Harris, who they had a few years ago. Dwayne Harris, he played on all four special teams units. You need players like that. So I think that combined with the experience from last year is going to help them. Here's, though, the other thing that should not be lost. Graham Gano was almost the MVP of the team last year at the kicker position, okay? Let's not dismiss what he did for the team. He was as close to automatic as you're going to get in terms of field goals, especially, and extra points. And you're bringing him back. Riley Dixon, you know, here's another punter that has some additional experience. He rode the wave of some ups and downs, but, you know, here's somebody that I think also he continues to improve. That should help their game as well. But Graham Gano, every time they got in field goal range, I think the coaching staff, you asked them, they felt pretty good that more often than not, you're going to get 3 points at least out of that possession. So there were some bright spots on special teams. I don't want to dismiss that completely, but I do think they need to shore up the coverage, and I think they want a little bit more explosion in the return game, and I certainly think Tony can answer that call.
Lance Meadow, pre- and post-game host for the New York Giants on WFAN, host of the Big Blue Podcast, host on Sirius XM Radio, Like I said, he had just gotten off the air with David Deal. Tell everybody where they could find you, where they could listen to you, and all that good stuff.
Well, I think he did an effective job pretty much laying out the entire resume.
Oh, wow.
I'll simply say I do a variety of shows on Sirius XM Mad Dog Sports Radio and Sirius XM NFL Radio. If people follow me on Twitter, I think that's the best way. I promote all of my shows through that venue on social media as well as on Facebook. And our Giants podcast is Big Blue Kickoff Live. It's a daily podcast Monday through Friday. And we pretty much give you inside outside coverage of what goes on with the Giants on a daily basis. And then, of course, once the season starts, including the preseason, you can hear me on the WFAN Giants Radio Network. I'll be doing the pre-half and post-game shows as I normally do. So a variety of different outlets that you can hear me on. And I'm certainly looking forward to the start of the NFL season once again, because you can only speculate so much about whether or not Aaron Rodgers is returning to the Packers. Thank goodness that's over and we can get closer to some X's and O's.
Should be a very exciting NFL season. We look forward to that just about a month away from now. September 9th will be the very first game of the NFL season. It will be Bucks Cowboys on Thursday Night Football on NBC. That should be a big, big match. Lance Meadows, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And best of luck to the Giants this coming season.
You got it, guys. Appreciate you having me on the program. Always enjoy the conversation. Thanks so much.
All right. When we
no problem, Lance.
When we come back, our MLB Top 10. Back after this. And we're back to Downtown Sports. I am the Beast of the East, Jonathan Perriente, along with my co-host, the Mouth of the South, John Schiavone. Want to thank Lance Meadow for joining us on part one of our show to go through the New York Giants, their upcoming schedule, their draft picks, and what we could see from the Giants now in their second year under Joe Judge and Jason Garrett, their offensive coordinators. Would be very, very interesting. Give a shout out quick to Tanya, aka Girl Friday,
our producer, who we've been very terrible about not shouting out. By the way, she's the one who's in control of our Twitter. Yes, we are on Twitter, so you could find her, you could follow her. She is running the Downtown Sports Twitter at @show_downtown. She's been taking care of the Downtown Sports Twitter. We thank her very much. Also want to thank Tony Mainville for this top 10, but you wanted to know where they could hear us, right?
Yeah. We are on 14 different platforms. Yeah. What are they, Mal?
I think they're Anchor, Breaker, Spotify, Radio Public, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, CastBox, Bullhorn, Podbay, Listed Notes, Verbal,
and Podcast Addict.
Yep.
14. Mm-hmm. 14 of them.
Wow.
And we thank each and every one of them for keeping our show on as we keep growing our brand every single week. Tuesday, Wednesdays, you can listen to us for rants, episodes, digital market battle specials. So we dive into this top 10. First one we've done since the All-Star break.
Mm-hmm.
A lot has changed in about a week and a half since the season turned, and trade deadline is very close to coming to an end.
Not much change. I don't know what you're talking about change.
Well, some little bits of change. We've already had some trades. Big moves already have been made.
Yes, we have.
We'll talk about them in a few minutes, but I want to see what our man, Tony Mainville, came up with here. I'm very curious to see now in a week and a half since the season, what's he put up there? And please, I hope I don't have to put like shocked expressions on my face when I hear who's on this top 10.
Okay. So let's just go through it really quickly. Number 10, The first in the National League East, New York Mets.
Okay.
They are the number 10 team. Fair. I don't know if that's fair after the terrible, few games they've had.
Okay.
McGill's out there pitching great right now.
It's been good. You're getting back Carlos Carrasco this weekend. I think that's going to really boost the Met starting staff. DeGrom's been doing better, I've heard lately. So
Rich Hill is now a Met.
That was a big move for the Mets to get a veteran left-hander. And so far in one start, Hill looked pretty good. Mets are going to need pitching, and they're going to need their starters to continue to give them outings like this. Hope Stroman can get it back together as well. And
yes,
we have Walker. He needs to kind of get it back together after two very bad starts.
Yes, he does. After the All-Star break, gets the spot on the All-Star team, comes back and just lays two eggs in a row. Not good.
Oh, no.
By the way, Tyler McGill, interesting stat on him. Mm-hmm. Against the rest of the major leagues, he has only given up, I believe, two runs in 22 innings, something like that. Against the Atlanta Braves in 9 innings, he's given up 5.5 runs.
McGill's got five runs. McGill's got an ERA up to this point of 1.91. Pretty good.
Yep. And the only team that has hit him so far is the Atlanta Braves.
Well, we'll see if he can keep the shutout streak going against the Braves tonight. We'll see. Let's go to number 9 on our top 10. Who have we got?
Not much of a change here. The Oakland Athletics, second in the AL West. They are second in the AL wild card race as well.
Yankees, I wouldn't count the Yankees out of that. They're only 2.5 games back. And, well, Oakland today won in very trouncing fashion, destroying the Padres 10-4. That was a big win if you're Oakland. They really needed it. Seattle is kind of coming right behind them, although Seattle just got blown out by the Astros 11-4. So even though they came back and won a game from down 6-0, they won 11-8, but then they lost a couple of tough games. The Mariners, though, I will not lie, they have been fighting of late. They've been fighting against the Astros. They've been rallying against them a little bit. They did an trade in between both of them during this series. And so far, at least, it seems to have kind of worked out for both of them. The Astros got Kendall Graveman, the closer from the Mariners, mm-hmm. which really took him by surprise. The Mariners ended up taking Abraham Toro. And both of them so far have made pretty much big contributions already in just two games of being traded.
Me and you. And you and me, no matter how we cross the dice, they learn to be.
We're happy together, aren't we?
They're working together.
Yep. The Oakland A's also did a trade today. They got Starling Marte from the Marlins, which was a very nice addition to their lineup.
Yes, that is.
Still need a little help with the bullpen a little bit. The starting staff with Manaea at the helm is, I think, fine. They traded Jesus Luzardo in that trade. So I think that's a good piece to let go of. He had not been pitching very well, and the A's will have at least enough in the back end of the pen where you can kind of feel okay about them. Still, the rotation is a little bit of a question for me.
They need an arm or two. Yeah. They need another arm or two before
You need another arm with Manaea.
You do.
Cole Irvin, 3 days to get it done. Cole Irvin, I'm a little up and down with, you know.
Because, look, Seattle's literally right on their tails. If the Angels get hot, they could do some damage to this wild card race. There's a lot of teams that Oakland has to deal with that are literally nipping at their heels.
Oakland is 6 back of Houston right now.
It's literally hold on to the wild card and possibly get the home game against the Rays. That's what the A's are playing for. Well, let's move on. Number 8, the team that you mentioned Oakland beating, the San Diego Padres. I believe they are third place in the NL West. They are the second place team in the NL wild card. So right now, the NL West has 3 teams going to the playoffs if the season were to end right now.
Still, my concern with the Padres, and I'm amazed they still have not addressed it, their starting staff is in shambles. Amazing how much Blake Snell has dropped off from where he was in the World Series just a year ago.
The Padres spent a lot of money to be mediocre so far. With the talent they have on that roster, they should be in first. They should be the best team in the NL West.
They have had injuries. I will not lie about it. Oh, in fact, we just have some breaking news coming in right now as far as a trade.
Okay.
It involves the Yankees.
Ooh.
It looks like they are just about to acquire Joey Gallo.
Oh, really?
Joey Gallo is now a New York Yankee. The Yankees also yesterday traded away 2 of their bullpen arms. Justin Wilson and Luis Sessa both were traded to the Reds.
But Joey Gallo being a Yankee,
that is going to be a big move. Right now, there's still no word yet on who they got in the trade. We're going to find out as we go.
Yankees now, are on the top 10.
Now, Gallo is a good pickup for one because he's a left-handed bat. Yankees haven't had a lefty bat. Problem with Gallo, he strikes out a lot.
Hold on. Did Cashman actually take a page out of Mouth's analytics book? See, Mouth's analytics book said Yankees need left-handed bats.
Well,
and they didn't have any. And now they got one, and not only one, but a really, really good one at that.
Yep.
Let's get to number seven on the list, though, really quickly.
We got
the Tampa Bay Rays. They are the first place team in the AL wild card race, second place in the AL East behind the Boston Red Sox. And
as dangerous as they are, the Rays always with this lineup. I don't know how they do it every year. I don't know how they do it with the pitching they have every year, but they never are out of a game.
Because they have some magical person always in the farm system ready to come up that we've never heard of. And they come in and just dominate the league.
I have to
look
credit
the Rays this year.
I have to credit the way their scouting and analytics team actually builds this team. For a team with as low a payroll in the majors as anybody, and they're able to just find players that are ready to play, that know their role to fill in. And when it's time to let go of them, the Rays know when to get rid of those pieces of dead weight and then replace them with new ones. This is a team that traded away Blake Snell.
Yep.
That traded away that let Charlie Morton go.
Because they believed in Tyler Glasnow.
Bullpen got hurt. Their main arm of their pen is hurt right now.
Yep.
And it's like they haven't missed a beat.
Well, they have, but not to the point where they're out of things.
Yeah. Even letting Rich Hill go to the Mets. Both teams that are in the heart of a playoff race, and they let Hill go to another playoff team.
Well, because their catching situation is not that great, so expect to see Matt Dwyer maybe come up to the majors and be a backup up there.
Yeah. But the Rays, you like what they have at this point.
Also, I believe the arm they got was a bullpen piece from the Mets. No? Somebody that was languishing in our minor leagues, Tommy Hunter, who has major league experience, so you could see him in a couple of days pitching for the Rays.
It's an arm that will definitely help them. I'm not going to lie.
Tide them over. It's not going to be like a earth shattering thing, but better than
it's
nothing.
Another arm that helps them.
Next on the list,
please,
is the Milwaukee Brewers. We're getting to our first place teams finally again. First in the NL Central, and they're going to stay there. I don't see a team that's going to get to the Brewers and take over the Brewers. I don't believe in the Reds.
They're seven games ahead of the second place Reds.
Yeah, I don't believe in the Reds. The Brewers are the best team in the Central. They're the most consistent team. They're the best pitching, best bullpen, best offense in the division.
The Brewers already with some of the moves they've made in this year have been big. Getting Willy Adames really helped turn their lineup around. Rowdy Tellez has been a revelation.
Wow.
Already with Milwaukee. He was barely hitting 200 with Jays this year. He goes over to the Brewers in less than 20 games and is hitting 350.
And well, let's get to the next team. The first place in the American League Central, the only team I know that doesn't swing on 3-0 counts ever at all and can still play as well as they do, the Chicago White Sox, managed by Tony La Russa, with pitching out the wazoo. Dallas Keuchel looks like he's turned the clock back a little bit.
They just had a very nice, and they put up a very incredible performance against the Brewers in Sunday night. Lance Lynn shut the Brewers down Sunday night. Heck, add in a base hit for him where he scored two runs on his own with a two-run single.
Yeah, didn't he always say he liked to hit?
He hadn't batted in 6 years.
He said he liked hitting. Oh, I remember him saying that at one point.
Well, he was a Cardinal at one point, so he had plenty of hitting in the National League as a Cardinal when he first broke into the league.
Well, that's gonna be a thing of the past next year.
Lance Lynn was one of those pitchers that everybody kind of never always talked about how good he was. He always had stuff. I never doubted Lance Lynn's
and
stuff.
Lance Lynn always went deep into games. That was the one thing about Lance Lynn.
Yeah, he did.
If you put him out there, well, this is before this year. Before this year.
You were getting at least seven innings out of it.
Seven innings. You were giving up four runs in those seven innings, but he was going seven. And you knew who was going to go seven every time out. He would give up about five hits, three runs, six hits, four runs.
You take that any day.
Serviceable starter. Serviceable, number five in your rotation.
And now he's this number year. One on this rotation. He's number one.
Wow. And the fact that he's saying that over Giolito, really?
Well, his ERA is below two.
Yep.
Giolito's been kind of a little up and down. I'm not saying Giolito's not going to figure it out. He certainly will. And then you have Rodon, who's been a revelation. Carlos Rodon, we don't even mention him. He's already had a no-hitter this year and almost had like at least two others this year already. And he's turned back the clock.
the White Sox are a dangerous team in the American League. I think that's the team that could go to the World Series.
If they get with all their pieces now, they just got back Eloy Jimenez in the lineup now to add another.
That's the most dangerous rotation in the American League right now.
Oh, they are. I think the White Sox are just beginning to make more noise in this Central, and they're going to make more noise around the majors.
And Tony La Russa, by the way, you could ask for no better manager in the postseason. He's seen it all.
Wait till they
get to the playoffs, guys.
Wait till they get to the playoffs.
Here's another dangerous team.
Number four, who we got?
The Boston Red Sox, with Kiki Hernandez hitting 400 in his last six games.
Mm-hmm.
Another one to just pop up and start. Oh, three home runs, nine RBIs in six games. And he's another dangerous hitter. Devers is still doing his thing. JD Martinez is still doing his thing. Bogarts is still the man. You literally have two contenders, maybe a third MVP contender on the Red Sox right now.
As we saw over the... Continue your point.
And this team literally... I'm not going to say it's running away with the division, but do you really see Tampa catching them? I don't. Do you see the Yankees catching them? I don't.
Well, Tampa's at least has the closest shot at them right now, considering how they've matched them move for move. They find ways to win games, just as Boston has. The Boston lineup and the Yankees had to learn this, unfortunately, the hard way last week.
Mm-hmm.
This lineup doesn't quit.
Nope.
Even when hit them for seven innings, they can just flip a switch.
That was pathetic. I don't understand how after 93 pitches.
I still have nightmares from that game.
Look, let me just say one thing before we go on. Aaron Boone, what the hell? I can't rage on this idiot enough. But I even thought he, as dumb as he could be sometimes, as married to his analytics book as he could be sometimes, after a softly hit, misplayed in the outfield double.
Analytics book comes back, says, Aaron, take out Roman.
And now put in
Jonathan Loaisiga.
And Loaisiga proceeds to do what?
Gives up four consecutive hits, does not get anybody out. All four of the hits were screamers. They were hard hit balls. So it was once a 4-0 game. In comes Loaisiga. It was 4-3 after Kike Hernandez hit that hard drive off him. And then that was when Britton came in the game. And then Boston scored two runs on fundamental style baseball.
You know, small ball, you know, that thing that was in the Yankees museum, used to see things like stealing bases and bunting runners over, you know, back in the 70s, right?
Those were the good old days.
My God. Hell, no, you actually saw this stuff about even 8 years ago, you know, teams playing small ball, pitching well, and, you know, trying to win games instead of, you know, home run, strikeout. People want to know where the game is boring. Give them something to freaking watch and stop taking small ball out of the game.
Exactly.
I'm done with that rant. Number three, the Houston Astros first in the AL West, and they're not banging on garbage cans to do it, supposedly.
The Astros are exactly who they are. I know people are still going to call them out, and it will never go away with the trash cans and
it shouldn't.
It will never.
It
go
shouldn't.
Away. That's
it should
never,
not
no,
go
it's
away.
It's never going to go away. No, that's going to be with them forever. Are you kidding?
As long as Altuve is a member of that team, it will never go away.
Altuve and everybody else that was on that 2017 team is all going to deal with it.
Well, Gerrit Cole's going to deal with it for the rest of his career, and he's a Yankee. It's going to follow him. Mm. George Springer is going to follow him.
2017, Gerrit Cole was not a Astro yet. He didn't become an Astro until 2018.
But they were still accused of cheating then too.
Yeah, well, that's another thing in and of itself. But Houston, we already talked about briefly a couple of the additions they just made with the Mariners, getting Kendall Graveman and swapping out Toro.
Wait, they what? No, we didn't. We didn't talk about that. We said we were going to get to it.
Yeah,
so
now we're going to get to it. So they made a couple of moves at the Astros.
Okay.
Well, one of them was with the Mariners getting trading off Toro to get Kendall Graveman to boost their pen, as well as trading Joe Smith to the Mariners in addition. And Graveman did not take that trade very well in the very beginning. Mariners couldn't even believe that Jerry DePoto even did that. Mariners are right there with the Strohs. You're right behind them. You could maybe catch them. They're playing good baseball. Why would you ruin something that you had going that was working well?
Well, because the Mariners were not expected to be a playoff team, so they're operating like they're still in a rebuild. They're just very happy with the results as of so far.
Well, now the Strohs got even stronger. They just acquired Yimi Garcia from the Marlins, another guy that closed games for them. The Strohs will send a prospect of theirs in Brian De La Cruz, and they'll also send Austin Pruitt over to the Marlins. That's a good move for the Strohs, at least getting another arm in their pen.
Yep.
That's big.
So the Strohs have acquired two closers practically, Graveman, is what you're telling me.
Graveman and Yimi Garcia to set up Ryan Pressly. Those are three good arms right there. Solid arms, actually.
7, 8, 9. Covered
and
right there.
And you have Stanek, who you could bring in if you need to. Stanek can.
Oh, the sixth arm. Inning. That's covered in the playoffs. So now basically the Astros only need to have a starter go 5 innings in the postseason. That's what you're telling me.
The only real good starter they even have at this point is Greinke. You're not getting Verlander back this year.
Nope.
I don't trust a lot of what Odorizzi can bring to the table. He's a little on and off as far as a starter is concerned for me.
And then that's why they tooled the bullpen.
The rest of the rotation is still a big question. Or Keeney's hurt. So they still have some questions in the starting rotation. I think Houston's not done making moves, though. I expect them to add another arm in that rotation at some point before the trade deadline.
Yep.
Don't be surprised. They've done this twice.
Yeah.
Acquired arms at the last minute. You've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So keep your eyes peeled on that. Let's go to number two.
Yeah. LA Dodgers.
Amazing how the Dodgers have fallen off, isn't it?
Yeah, but, Chris Taylor is still getting it done.
Yeah, but the Dodgers of late have been bad. The Giants came back twice to beat them in their place.
Yep.
The Rockies even beat them in Colorado. Yep. And then last night, again against the Giants, Cody Bellinger forgot how to field a ball. Giants end up winning the game 2-1.
Well, luckily for them, the Padres are playing the bat is horrendously.
But the Giants keep winning, and the Dodgers are falling further and further behind it. Don't think the Padres may not leapfrog the Dodgers at some point.
You don't know, but
Dodgers have played well against the Dodgers this year. Dodgers have played very well against the Dodgers.
Dodgers are still waiting for some pieces to come back, though.
Yeah, but like, you're not getting back Bauer. Good luck with that.
Yeah, no, he's not pitching in a Dodgers uniform ever again.
When's Kershaw coming back?
Yeah, that's a good question. Postseason, maybe?
Oh, that's not good. Then you can't wait that long. Arias can only do so much. Walker Buehler can only do so much.
Chris is going to be so angry when he hears you say all these bad things.
Jansen has been struggling of late. He's been looking a lot more human of late.
You know, this list looks very familiar.
Really?
It's the same order as before the All-Star break. Number one is the Giants, obviously.
Oh, no surprise.
Because,
Don't think the Giants aren't going to add a few arms or maybe add another piece or two to their team.
They might. They got a farm system to trade out of.
Strong one, I might add. A very strong one. The great thing is, again, what the Giants have at their disposal. They have so many interchangeable parts.
Anybody and their rotation just gets the job done. Their rotation goes out, and every pitcher is giving you 6 innings and 3 runs.
Sometimes, again, their games where the Dodgers, where the Giants don't even need 5 or 6 innings out of their guys. They can have a bullpen guy go 3 innings, whatever, then piece it together with all the arms you have in your pen. Everyone in that Giants bullpen is solid. You can go to any one of them. You can use them at any given time. You can use your closer in the eighth and put Tyler Rogers in for the ninth, or you could switch it around.
Yep.
That's the beauty of having flexibility and interchangeable parts.
That's the beauty of being able to trust at least 11 of your 12 to 14 arms on your major league roster.
Who'd have thought Gabe Kapler was going to go from a situation in Philly where he was getting ridiculed for everything?
Yep.
He goes out west to San Fran.
And he's turned Kevin Gausman into one of the best starters in the league. he would be having a Cy Young year right now if it weren't for Jacob DeGrom. Well, depending on how long Jacob DeGrom stays out, that might be in question.
Gausman may surpass him.
If DeGrom stays out for a long time.
But I have a feeling it won't be for very long. DeGrom seems to be moving along in the right direction. So
yes, he does.
But the Mets can really use his arm in that rotation really now. Yes.
Look, they could, especially with the stretch of games, the Phillies and the Braves that they got coming up. They got to play their own division and they got to win these games because these teams are right on their heels. Granted, nobody's closer than about 4.5 games back right now. But I'll be honest with you, I don't think the Nationals are coming back into the mix. Max Scherzer could become a Yankee.
Especially now that the Nats had a COVID outbreak, 12 players tested positive.
Well, Max Scherzer might actually end up being a Yankee.
It's not going to happen. Scherzer has already hinted in where he wants to go, and New York is not one of them. Neither is one of them.
Oh, so where is he
saying? He wants to go out west. He's looking to go out west.
Oh, so Giants.
Giants could snack up Scherzer.
Could you imagine that, Gausman and Scherzer?
That'd be filthy.
That would be.
Heck, maybe the Dodgers take a move on him, right?
That could also – wow. A lot of different ways this can go. We got 3 days left for the trade deadline. The Mets are looking at Javier Baez. He actually came out and said he'd love to play with Francisco Lindor for the rest of his career.
Really? Bringing endorsement.
Or he wants to play with Francisco Lindor for a long time. Something of that nature. Said he wants to play with Lindor. So perhaps that's something the Mets should be looking at. I know they've been linked to Chris Bryant a lot, but if you got a guy in Baez that really wants to come play second base here, that I'm for it.
I would not even hesitate. I would not even hesitate.
I would give the Cubs what they want. I'd be like, okay, what do you want? Okay, great. Here you go.
There are still moves to be made, ladies and gentlemen, and we're going to find out very soon.
Here, Guillaume, go be a Cub. Look, they got Ivy on the brick wall in the outfield. You'll love it.
Well, let's see where all this goes in a matter of 3 days. We're almost at the end of the trade deadline, and more moves are still coming. But with that, it's going to wrap up our MLB Top 10. When we come back, we dive into the Olympic Games.
Oh, my God.
Tokyo, Japan. Really, not the games everybody had imagined, not the games people, I think, were expecting to see.
Not at all.
COVID-19.
Yep.
The games basically are a year late.
That and, we have athletes that were obviously superior, scored and had points taken away because they didn't know how to score, how amazing she was. So you pretty much had to have like a handicap.
Well,
we'll talk about that
of one particular athlete. Yes. And then we have concerns with our own basketball team. Big concerns. We're going to talk about that and more. We'll be back right after this.
And we're back to Downtown Sports on the Mouth of the South, John Schiavone, along with my co-host, the Beast of the East, Jonathan Parodiente. Now, our boy Chris DeLarge had prepared a top 10 for us, prepared a top 10 draft picks, list for us for the NBA. We'll get to that next week. But this week, we have to get to a couple of things. The U.S. Olympics. Now, I believe we are winning in terms of overall total of medals, the USA is.
Yep, we have 31 medals up to this point.
We are behind in gold medals, I'm pretty sure.
Japan is number one with 13. We have 11 gold medals.
But you would think, well, that's great. That's just unreal.
The Olympic Games have not had the feel of previous. You can feel it.
Yeah.
The fact that they decided to have these games when we're in a pandemic, the majority of the world didn't want it. Japan even themselves didn't want it. But the International Olympic Committee went along with it anyway. They were already delayed for 1 year because of COVID. The games were supposed to be last year, but due to the severity of the pandemic, they canceled it, held it, suspended it till the next year.
Yep.
Fans are not in the stands. They weren't there for the opening ceremonies. They've not been there for the most part for all the Olympic events. Maybe it might change over time, but
don't think so.
So the Olympics up to this point have really not been as exciting and as thrilling as you would like. Normally you love to cheer a country of yours when they're playing in these games. You look forward to going to those gathering parties at the bar, coming home from work, you're watching your fellow United States athletes compete. But we've been surrounded for a whole year in swirl of racism, whole swirl of not respecting our flag or kneeling through the anthem, the BLM. It's been back and forth of this for the past year. And
as you've been, hold on. The only thing I'll say, I believe our athletes and I believe in our ability to not worship the flag like it's some sort of like, you know, mythical being that can never be disrespected. First off, if you kneel in front of the flag, it's respectful. I don't even want to get into that whole conversation, right? Here's the part that I do want to get into. The fact of the matter is, in these two instances, our country hasn't been represented all that well, whether it's been athletes, media's reaction to athletes, beasts, just get into it. Let's talk about Simone Biles.
Yeah. One such athlete, and it really is incredible how all this happened in the span of a day, really. There was Simone Biles getting ready to compete in the team and individual all-around for women's gymnastics. She's the anchor of that gymnastics team. Won gold in the Rio event just 5 years ago. And suddenly, I was watching Biles practice on the vault, and she was not nailing her jumps as she usually does. In fact, she was way off the center of the mat, didn't look confident in any of her jumps, and that, for me, raised a bit of a red flag. Then Biles, after one vault in the start of the event, pulled the plug. That was it. It's kind of crazy, and we find out it was not an injury. It was a mental issue. Basically, kind of something of what happened to someone else that represented her sport well and actually just came back to light the torch at the opening ceremonies in Tokyo, in Naomi Osaka. Didn't we like just have this conversation no more than about 2 months ago?
Yeah, Naomi Osaka's case was the French Open, where she pulled out because she did not feel that her mental health state would be able to handle dealing with the reporters after every match, after every time she plays. She wanted to not have to do that, but the French Open said, nope, if you compete, you have to do that. So she left.
And now the same problem surfaced with Biles, similarly. So Biles chose to withdraw from both the individual and the team all around. Now, the U.S. won silver in the team all around, despite Biles not competing, which was huge. But there's been back and forth about how Biles did it, with just deciding I have a mentally, I'm not into it. I have to step away. I have to think about my own health. From some, it's drawn praise from people like Ali Reisman, former teammate of hers, from Michael Phelps, who himself had issues with mental issues during the events. He had to step away for a little while. He came back. And now you kind of have to look at it this way with Olympic athletes who, when the stress gets to these athletes, people, you know, we don't look at the athletes from in their mindset of, you know, there's a lot of weight on their shoulders to represent your country, to you're one of the top athletes. And the people out there constantly expect you to be perfect every single time. And God, goodness gracious, if you're not, guess what you hear from people? You failed our country.
You're not tough. You failed.
You're a disgrace to our country. You're a disgrace to the United States. Kurt Angle wrestled on a broken freaking neck.
Oh, yeah. I heard that one about 100 times.
Oh, you couldn't wrestle because you couldn't do gymnastics because you had a mental breakdown. You couldn't do it anymore.
Let me just explain this really quickly. So Simone Biles actually, when asked about the withdrawal, she says, I don't trust myself as much as I used to. I'm a little bit more nervous when I do gymnastics. I feel like I'm also not having as much fun. Now, let's just say this. I think the she also said in the morning practice that she had a case of the twisties. Now, the twisties are a mysterious phenomenon. If you watch gymnastics or do gymnastics, this is a term that you might know. It's when suddenly a gymnast is no longer able to do a twisting skill she's done thousands of times before. Body just won't cooperate. Your brain loses track of where you are in the air, and then you're just slamming into the ground.
Yeah, the twisties. I'm going to actually want to thank the New York Post for kind of explaining it a little bit to us what the twisties are. It causes someone to lose their sense of space and dimension as they're in the air. Causes them to lose control of their body. They may perform extra twists or flips that they hadn't intended to do. The person may find themselves unable to land safely on the floor. The strange occurrence can happen to any gymnast, even if they've done the same routine over and over without issue. So Simone Biles, this happened to even one of the greatest of all time. But just think about that for a brief moment. A lot of things could have happened that can cause this. Nerves can happen.
Let me just say this.
Stress.
If you can't do physically demanding things like the flips or anything like that, if you're getting a case of you don't know where you are in the air,
you're putting yourself in harm's way.
Yeah.
Dangerous harm's way, I might add.
Not only are you putting yourself in harm's way, could you imagine if a gymnast got the twisties, as they call it, and they don't know where they are and their head or their neck is what hits the ground? The whole event's canceled. Everything's over. Mm-hmm. Somebody's dead and the Olympics suffer. So imagine
on the balance beam, you're doing a flip.
Yep.
And your head hits that balance beam.
Oh, yeah. Concussion protocol. You think you get a concussion in the NFL? Let me tell you where you get a concussion: on a gymnastics balance beam when you're trying to do a 360 flip. Get that wrong and see what happens to you.
You literally are constantly putting your life on the line in gymnastics.
And if you screw up just this much, you're dead. Tell me any other sport where that happens.
WWE, wrestling, professional wrestling. The flips those wrestlers are all doing
are not even close to what these women are doing.
No,
truthfully, but
they are high risk nonetheless.
Yes.
They're all high risk. And for Simone Biles, and I hope whatever help she gets, she rightfully deserves, will get her back to where she was, hopefully very soon. It's a big issue, and Naomi Osaka was the first one to kind of open the door about maybe athletes and mental health and thinking about their mental health over their actual performance all the time. There is always a thing where family comes first before your sport, right? Mental health should come first before your events. You have to take all those things into account. And now Simone Biles, here she comes bringing up the same point. Maybe now Biles may kick that door down.
Hopefully.
That mental health needs to be more addressed in these sports than ever now.
And you know, a lot of people made fun of Marshawn Lynch for talking about that.
He said, I was here so I don't get fined.
Yeah.
He brought up to me just for his own reasons. It wasn't mental or any of that stuff. He just didn't like to talk to the media.
But he even said, like, you know, I don't like speaking to the media. It makes me nervous. I don't like speaking to the media. It makes me nervous. He said that a couple of times. People made fun of him for it, not wanting to speak to the media. And now look at Simone Biles. It's not that she didn't want to speak to the media. Her head made it so that she was dangerous doing gymnastics. And then Naomi Osaka, who was just scared to get in front of the media. Like, why is this a part of me having to play tennis right now? So she withdrew from the French Open. So this is common. And by the way, just want to bring up a couple of examples. If you think mental health is not important for sports or athletes, or, oh, athletes really don't deal with mental health problems, look at Junior Seau. You don't think there was any mental health issues going on after his football career? What about Belcher, the young gentleman who shot himself in front of Romeo Crennel?
Yep.
Mental health's not a problem. I'm glad that Simone Biles pulled out before she ended up doing something dangerous to herself. And one more thing.
No.
Finish your point.
Yeah.
Because I'm
upset. Big issue. It's a big issue that now is beginning to get more notice. I worry, though, for another athlete that has something like what Biles or Osaka had, forget that it just tells him, you know, I know when I have to step away. What if the next athlete that has this mental breakdown in the middle of their game or routine gets seriously hurt? That's my big worry.
Yep.
Biles was lucky. The next one might not be. But while Biles gets her matters straightened out, and I wish her the best of luck in it, there's another team, there's another crew from the U.S. that has to get its matters straightened out. Have you been watching them of late?
USA, the Dream Team?
Yeah, the U.S. Right. men's basketball team. They were expected to run the gauntlet and blow everybody away, right? NBA All-Stars, right?
Everybody. Oh, I'm blown away. Yeah, I'm blown away, all right.
Really?
I'm blown away by how terrible they are. By the way, don't worry. The U.S. got their first Olympics win against Iran last night. So,
yeah, blew them out 120-67.
Oh, yeah. That's great. Meanwhile, we lost to France in game one. France.
So French team was very strong. I'm not going to say they weren't prepared. The French have a good group of NBA talent. And then, of course, obviously, then you look at the exhibition games before that. U.S. got destroyed by Australia and Nigeria.
I want to give you guys, everybody, right, ready?
Mm-hmm.
The average point totals for each of these players over two games.
I'm scared to hear about this.
The leader on the points total is Damian Lillard, averaging 16 points. Drew Holiday.
That's half of what he gets.
Averaging 13 points. Jason Tatum, averaging 11 points. Zach LaVine, 10 points. Devin Booker, 10 points. Kevin Durant, 10 points. And then after that, all below double digits. Bam Adebayo, 9. And then a steep drop to JaVale McGee with 5. Chris Middleton with 5. Jermai Grant with 4. Draymond Green averaging 3.5 points per game. Keldon Johnson with a wonderful number of 2 points per game.
I could understand for a couple of these athletes. Maybe you could forgive me if I'm being a little fair to a few athletes. I mean, Middleton and Booker, you know, they just played in the NBA Finals literally just days ago. You know, probably a little still kind of worn out from that, I can understand. But for people like a Lillard, for people like a Draymond Green, for people
a Kevin
like
Durant,
a Kevin Durant,
Bam Adebayo,
you've had about a good month or so to rest and get yourself back into NBA basketball playing shape. You know, you've had about a month to get kind of yourself back in. I wonder, does the U.S. men's basketball team even care to be here at all?
I don't know. They don't play like it.
Are they showing to you like they want to be here?
And then you have guys saying, oh, wow, you know, these international players, they play different when they're representing their country. It's because they have something called pride. So unless you're getting paid millions and millions, you don't care.
And you notice that also, and I think, you know, it was kind of interesting. You remember a while back when a couple of LeVar Ball's kids went to play in Lithuania, to play basketball in Europe?
Yep.
Europe is really where boys turn into men. When you play in European basketball, you are playing with big men. They're going to play more physical than they do in the NBA. It's a lot different than what the NBA is doing with all the soft fouls and all the
Antetokounmpo brother. Look at these guys, the Antetokounmpo brothers, born in Greece of Nigerian descent. Look at guys like, well, let's go to the past, Tony Parker. Let's go to the past again, Dirk Nowitzki. Let's go to Luka Doncic in today's game, Kristaps Porzingis in today's game. Danilo Gallinari, who is in Italy leading the Italian basketball team. You know, international players have made big, big impacts in NBA game. It's not like, you know, NBA basketball is all the best American players and everybody internationally is playing in their own country. Nah, all the best players in the world are in the NBA. And a lot of the guys that you're seeing get consideration for MVP awards, titles, defensive players of year. They all come from Europe, from Africa, from other places in the world besides the United States of America.
The U.S., I think what we're beginning to notice here, the U.S. is maybe not as dominant as they used to be anymore either.
I think the rest of the world's caught up. Look.
Yeah. Look at all the talent over the years that has come to the NBA from overseas. Look at all of it.
And do you know what? A local French play-by-play announcer for the France men's Olympic team said this while France was beating the pants off of the United States by 7 points, 83-76. That was so pathetic. Mm-hmm. He was screaming in French that the French were beating the inventors of this game at their own game.
Big words, and very, I think it's words need to be brought to the attention of the United States. And you wonder, it could be, again, could be, it's a lot of things. Could it be just, oh, you know, a lot of this U.S. team hasn't played with one another before? Maybe. I don't think you can really throw that excuse out there. Could it be of all, maybe they're playing too much in Popovich's system since he's coaching the team and not Coach K anymore? Kind of funny how Coach K, when he coached the U.S., he only had one loss under him.
But when you had entire career.
One loss the entire time as an Olympic coach. You bring in Popovich, how many losses have the U.S. team had right now?
Three in 2021.
Three in 1 year. You wonder if maybe the U.S. is playing too much of Popovich's system, or maybe, you know, Popovich wants the U.S. team to play kind of the way his Spurs do.
Or maybe Team USA went in here thinking, oh, this is going to be easy. This is going to be a cakewalk. We're going to walk out on the court. We're going to play like we're playing practice pickup ball, and we're going to win a gold medal.
You know, that's kind of what happened to some of the great. That's what happens to a lot of the great teams. They think they're untouchable. They get civilized, if you will.
Yeah.
Kind of like what happened with Rocky and Clubber Lang, right? Remember that little Rocky was on top of the world. Nobody could beat him.
Well, the U.S. did respond. Hungry. The U.S. responded.
For this game against Iran, yes. I hope, though, it's not a just a little hushing of the crowd. I want to see the U.S. dominate like that in their next game and the game after that and the game after that, and then eventually going all the way to the medal game.
What I hope, they get there. What I hope, ready?
Yep.
I hope that this was an aberration.
Aberration, yeah.
I hope, because if it's not, this will be the first team from the United States of America to not win the gold medal since the 1990s.
I remember also the
32 years mm-hmm. of nothing but gold. And I thought Kevin Durant was the best player in the world.
Where's Kevin Durant been in this whole series?
Averaging 10 points a game. Same thing with Devin Booker. But Drew Holiday was the man. Oh, no. 13 a game. Averaging.
Well, as I
said, seven assists per game. That's great.
Well, as I said, for players like a Holiday and a Middleton, you know, they just came off winning a title.
What's Lillard's excuse?
Yeah, what is Lillard's excuse? Is right. What's Durant's excuse?
16-8, not good enough. 10.
U.S. took bronze. We forgot that loss. Remember that one loss by Krzyzewski. Remember when the U.S. lost in 2004 in Athens? It took bronze that year. They didn't take gold in 2004.
Right now, the United States is averaging under 100 points per game.
And that's not typical United States.
Nope.
I think also we're noticing the U.S. is playing too much of the isolation style of basketball that we've been seeing in today's NBA. So many threes, stylish looking points. The teams that the U.S. are facing in the Olympics are playing team basketball.
Yep.
Constantly moving the ball around.
They're not looking at that analytics book saying you got to shoot nothing but threes.
The analytics now has not only made its way in our local sports, it's made its way even into international sports. Even in the Olympic Games now, analytics has reared its head here.
Because Popovich is a big student of analytics, as we all know.
Well, at some point, analytics can only take you so far. You have to use your own guts and your own abilities.
And Pop knows how to do that. I mean, he's a champion multiple times over in the NBA, probably the best coach remaining in the game.
But you can't rely on analytics forever. You have to use your own instincts. You have to use your own talent.
And if you look at this team, right? Holiday is a student of Popovich's system through Budenholzer. You have the same thing with a couple of these guys, Middleton as well. I believe a few of these players are from coaches that were under the Popovich tree. So it's very possible that, you know, they might understand the system a little bit, could play through it. I don't think Popovich's system is so hard that players like Adebayo and Durant and McGee and Grant aren't green or aren't going to be able to get it. I think they should be able to, but Draymond Green, especially 3.5 points per game. He's only scored 7 points in the entire Olympics.
That should concern you. That should concern you to a degree. You know,
to Draymond a degree, Green concerns me a lot.
On being a good leader, Draymond Green always prides himself on being a great leader and a big presence on defense.
Yep.
Where's his defense been?
I don't know. You asked me, but you know what? We're going to have to wrap here, but I just have one message. Mm-hmm. To Team USA men's basketball.
Yes.
Get it together and do it quickly. We let the Nigeria loss go and we let the Australia loss go because, well, they didn't count.
But then we lost to France
on the 25th. And you know what? They beat Iran. On the 28th, they were recording it almost by 60 points. So that's a good response, although nobody expected Iran to do anything in the Olympics at all. So we need to see what America is going to do against these other teams. We're going to see what Team USA can do.
Well, here's the U.S.'s next game. July 31st against the Czech Republic.
And I believe they're led by a very famous player, are they not?
Well, remember, Doncic represents Slovenia.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's see. They don't have any NBA names that we really know of. You have Tomas Satoransky. That's the only NBA. Jan Vesely was another former NBAer. So they have a couple of names here, but still, they're going to play a very physical style of basketball, just like all the European basketball teams do. They're big and they play physical. And the U.S. is going to have to be able to match that. They have to have people that can match that physicality, and they're going to have to score some ugly points if they have to, if they want to win.
And remember, France is already up in Group A. They're 2-0 because they beat the Czech Republic team by 20 points.
Yes.
So U.S. needs to take care of business against the Czech Republic and get it done so this way they can get out of this grouping and go into the medal games.
Yeah. Does not get any easier. For the United States, this does not get any easier.
No, it doesn't. And if the Czech Republic beats the United States, they could go on and beat Iran. And then could you imagine
a good game? U.S. can't even afford to lose another game.
No, they can't.
Or they're out.
They can't. Yeah.
Period. All right. On that note, that wraps up today's edition of Downtown Sports. I want to thank our statistician, Chris DeLarge, our researcher, Tony Mainville. Shout out to our producer, Girl Friday, Tanya, for her work that she does. Want to thank Lance Meadow for joining us for the first half of our show. You can listen to Downtown Sports on 14 different platforms. We're on Anchor, Breaker, Spotify, Radio Public, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, CastBox, Bullhorn, Podbay, Listen Notes, Podcast Addict, and Verbal. Rants, episodes, digital market battle specials every Tuesday, Wednesday. We are Downtown Sports. We are where sports come home.
For the Beast of the East, Jonathan Perriente, on the Mouth of the South, John Schiavone, saying, we're out. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.